Please be seated. Good afternoon. This is our third case for today and last case this week. 09AP2057CR State v. David W. Stevens. Arguing for David W. Stevens is Paul Lizotte, Assistant State Public Defender. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Paul Lizotte, and I represent David Stevens. On behalf of Mr. Stevens, I'm requesting that the Wisconsin Supreme Court reverse the Court of Appeals decision and affirm the Circuit Court's order suppressing all of Mr. Stevens' statements made after the first custodial interrogation. In my view, there are two grounds for doing so. First, under Miranda and its progeny, I maintain that after a suspect in custody personally invokes his Fifth Amendment Miranda rights to counsel, law enforcement may not legitimately deny that suspect access to an attorney asking to see the suspect unless there are some appropriate reasons for denying access. Second, I think that the Circuit Court correctly applied and relied on State versus Middleton. Relying on Middleton, the Circuit Court concluded that Stevens' second waiver of counsel, which occurred around 3 p.m., was unknowing because the police did not inform Stevens that after he previously personally invoked his right to counsel around 10:35 a.m., attorney Jennifer Ewan had attempted to see him at the police station around 1 p.m., but was not allowed to do so. Relying on Middleton, as well as the Circuit Court's reasoning, it is my position that Mr. Stevens' ability to make a knowing and intelligent waiver of his Fifth Amendment rights to counsel effectively disappeared when the police failed to inform him that after he invoked his Fifth Amendment Miranda rights to counsel, an attorney attempted to see him but was not allowed to do so.
Was that attorney an attorney that represented him on other cases?
Correct.
Did that attorney say, I'm here to see him on the new charges, or is that in the record?
It's in the record. My understanding was she told the supervising detective, Lieutenant Graham, that my client, David Stevens, is in jail and I want to see him. But she didn't specify what particular case number or charge she was appointed to represent him on.
Is there anything in the record to show? I mean, if a lawyer goes to visit their client in jail, typically they can see their client.
Typically that is allowed, especially when it's a staff public defender. If they would show up at a jail or a police station, they would be allowed to see the client.
Had he been charged yet?
He had not been charged in this case.
Was she his lawyer for some other case?
Correct. One of the charges he was arrested on in this particular case was a charge of bail jumping, which related to he had a pending case for failure to update the sex offender registry, and he was released on bail in that case. And the incident in this case constituted a charge of bail jumping.
Oh, so he would have been arrested for on the charge of bail jumping as well as
correct.
A new offense?
Correct. He faced charges of first-degree sexual assault of a child as well as a charge of bail jumping.
And she was his lawyer in a related case for bail jumping?
Well, she was actually his attorney on the failure to register case.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. On which he was released on bail.
That's what I meant by related to.
Okay, so he wasn't being held on the previous case. He was only being held on the new matter.
Correct. It was a new arrest on the new charges.
Somehow I was thinking he might have been in custody on the other matter, maybe, I don't know what, on bond or I don't know.
At the time of the incidents in this case, he was free on bail in the registry case.
Okay, thank you.
Well, why would she think she would represent him on these new charges?
I think it's typical practice of the public defender's office if one of the staff attorneys is already representing a client on one case and the client faces a new case that the attorney will also be responsible for the new case.
Mr. Lazat, let me ask you factually about this. This is sort of an interesting factual situation all the way around. But you've got a defendant who says, I want to invoke my right to counsel. Then, as I understand it, he gets back to the holding cell, and he says, I really want to talk to you again. I'm going to waive my right to counsel again. You could look at the fact that he's initiated further contact and that he says he's going to waive his right to counsel again as a withdrawal of the invocation of the right to counsel. How would you respond to that?
My understanding of Detective Haynes' testimony on that point is as he got Mr. Stevens back to the holding cell, Mr. Stevens made clear that he did want to continue speaking, and then Detective Haynes pointed out that you've invoked your right to counsel, therefore I can't speak with you unless your attorney's present or an attorney is present. And my understanding of Detective Haynes' testimony is that Stevens indicated at that point a willingness in the future, an openness to waiving his right to counsel if they could continue the conversation right then. It's my position that the suspect merely initiating contact with the police after invoking the right to counsel is not in and of itself the waiver. That's a necessary prerequisite fact to create a situation where there can be a subsequent knowing and intelligent waiver of the right to counsel.
And apparently that waiver of the right to counsel didn't come until around 3 o'clock in the afternoon?
Correct. It was around 3 p.m.
Let me ask you about Middleton. Middleton was the case that was relied on by Judge Maudsley, as I understand it. And yet there's clearly some question as to whether or not Middleton retains any vitality under our case law. I understand that in the Anson case, a portion of Middleton was overruled, but not the portion that you're using in your argument here. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And yet we've now got a case decided, I think, last term called the Bloom case, whereby we seem to take the position that if this court overrules a decision of the Court of Appeals, that case has no vitality for the future. How do you handle Bloom and Anson and Middleton in this situation?
Yes, Your Honor. As I understand Bloom, the court pointed out there that a Court of Appeals decision overruled by the Wisconsin Supreme Court retains no precedential value unless the Wisconsin Supreme Court expressly states otherwise. My understanding of Anson, when the Wisconsin Supreme Court overruled a portion of Middleton in that case, they were focusing specifically on the Harrison hearing. In other words, if a defendant does testify at his trial, there needs to be a determination of whether the defendant's testimony was, in effect, the fruit of the poisonous tree of admitting out-of-court statements that should have been suppressed. The Middleton Court of Appeals said that making that determination, the circuit court could conduct a new evidentiary hearing related to that matter. The Anson Supreme Court said, no, this Harrison hearing is simply a paper review of the existing record. And they repeated in three different paragraphs that they were, the Anson Court repeated in three different paragraphs that they were overruling Middleton to the extent that it held the circuit court may take additional evidence at the Harrison hearing. As I understand the use of that language, they're making clear Middleton, we're retaining Middleton's ruling on the Miranda violation. We're only overruling it with respect to the subsequent Harrison determination.
Also, Bloom, wasn't that a direct appeal on the conviction so that you were overruling the same case?
Bloom versus First Auto was a civil case involving an insurance contract. and they mention that as it came from the Court of Appeals to the State Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals had relied on a portion of an earlier Court of Appeals case, Hemmerly, that had been overturned by the State Supreme Court in Hull. And in Hull, when the Supreme Court overturned Hemmerly, they left a footnote saying, for the sake of clarity, we choose to overrule Hemmerly rather than limit it to its facts. So it seems to me that in Hull, the court was expressly declaring, effectively was just expressly declaring, we're overruling Hemmerly in its entirety. We're not going to try to distinguish it based on its facts. Well, as I understand,
what's the rule of Middleton that you want protected?
I think the rule of Middleton that I want protected is that once the law enforcement is aware that the suspect in custody has requested to consult with an attorney, if that attorney shows up at the police station, the suspect is put in a position where the circumstances have changed and he cannot make a knowing waiver, a knowing and intelligent waiver of his very important right to consult with counsel unless the police let him know that the attorney has been there.
Now, did he specifically ask for this lawyer?
He made reference to, I want my attorney. But in the transcripts, there's nothing indicating that he said her name.
So it's once the suspect says he wants to consult with an attorney,
right,
unnamed, not even have a lawyer, right?
Right. I think it's a very significant fact if the suspect just simply invokes, I choose to invoke my Fifth Amendment right to consult with an attorney.
Okay, and the lawyer shows up here on request of the mother, right?
Attorney Ewan, right, received, had a phone message from the mother.
And I suppose that if the mother called a blind and she didn't know who this person was and didn't have any relationship with him previously as counsel, she might or might not have come.
I think that's a reasonable inference.
So you've got the mother makes the call, but this lawyer already has a client-attorney relationship with him. And according to your statement, the public defender's office ordinarily would appoint the same lawyer for all of the particular client's criminal issues.
Correct.
So if you change the facts that mother calls and gets a lawyer that has no relationship to the defendant, how does that fit under Middleton?
I think
not the facts of this case.
Right. I think Middleton would still apply because, in my view, the critical linchpin fact here is Mr. Stevens informing Detective Haynes that I'm personally invoking to you my right to consult with an attorney. And so then that knowledge should be imputed to the entire police department at that point. So therefore, if you have a suspect who's arrested on his very first offense and would invoke that Miranda right to custody, it would be my position if somehow a relative of his found out about the situation, sent down an attorney, that the same reasoning would apply. That suspect has invoked his right to consult with an attorney and should be allowed to do so.
Does the United States Supreme Court decision support your position?
I believe it does. In particular, in the Miranda decision itself, and this is at 384 U.S. at 474, 86 Escort at 1628, quote, if the individual states that he wants an attorney, the interrogation must cease until an attorney is present. At that time, the individual must have an opportunity to confer with the attorney and to have him present during any subsequent questioning. And the way I read that language is it's saying that if the individual invokes that right to consult with an attorney and an attorney shows up at that time, the suspect should be allowed to consult with the attorney.
But what about, is it Moran versus Burbine? How does that fit? I mean, Miranda has some very nice sentences throughout it, mm-hmm. but I'm not so sure they're all still good law. and that the court hasn't put a gloss on some of those sentences. So how do you explain the Moran case, the Burbine case?
Right. I think a critical distinction between the instant matter and Moran versus Burbine is that in Moran versus Burbine, at no point did the suspect ever personally make a request for an attorney. And I think that same logic would apply as well to our state cases, State versus Ward, State versus Jones, and State versus Hansen. In each of those cases, the suspect himself or herself never personally invoked the right to counsel.
So if you don't invoke the right to counsel, and mother sends an attorney who's banging at the jailhouse door saying, I want to see my client, the police officer, law enforcement, does not have to stop questioning.
Correct. In that instance, if the suspect does not personally invoke the right, I agree. The police do not have to allow that attorney access.
But if they do invoke it, then you say no questioning for, unless you let them see the lawyer, and then they waive.
Correct.
Can I clarify this? Suspect invoked his right to counsel and unequivocally, and the questioning stopped, and they went to the cell, took him back to the cell. And then I think reading your brief, there was discussion about, oh, maybe I would like to waive this. What if the officer had said, okay, let's go back to the interrogation room and talk? Would that have been all right or not?
Yeah, I think that would have radically changed the facts if the detective had said at that point, you want to talk, okay, let's go back to the interview room right now. And then you go on the record and make it clear the defendant is initiating the contact at that point. And then subsequent to that goes through a knowing and intelligent waiver of the right to counsel. And the attorney hasn't showed up at that point, I think that's a very different case.
So the difference for you is the fact that the attorney showed up?
Well, the difference for me is the fact that he invoked his right and the attorney showed up prior to him knowingly and intelligently waiving his right to consult with her. And at that point, when he had invoked his right, had not knowingly and intelligently waived that right, and the attorney is there saying, I would like to see my client, at that point, I say that's where the violation occurred. She should have either been allowed to see him, or at a minimum, the police should have informed him, Attorney Ewan is here and would like to speak with you.
Counsel, is there any reason to believe that the defendant had talked to his mother about requesting counsel?
There's information in the record that suggests that happened. There was no specific finding of fact made on that. After the state filed its notice of appeal, there was a request to supplement the record with additional facts. And when that was in front of the circuit court judge, the state indicated that it had information it received after the suppression hearing that the mother said, David called me from the jail and asked me to contact Attorney Ewan for him. And then at that point, no additional evidence was taken. The circuit court judge said, you know, I've made my decision. I don't see the need to reopen the record. And also trial counsel at that point as well did not want to reopen the record.
So that information was never actually made part of the record?
That particular information. In the record, what's in the record is a phone message, a photocopy of a phone message that was taken at the public defender office for Attorney Ewan at approximately 12:07 p.m. that David Stevens' mother called, he's in the jail, he's in trouble. So the record does reflect that David Stevens' mother called Attorney Ewan's office at approximately 12:07 p.m. precisely what pushed the mother to make that call is unclear.
But the slip itself is part of the record.
Correct. The slip itself is in the record.
I read the footnote 4 of the Court of Appeals opinion on this very issue, and it kind of made me smile because it appears to me that earlier in the appeal, they indicate they remanded to the circuit court to take additional evidence, and they didn't direct them to take additional evidence. They said if warranted. But apparently the circuit court either didn't take the hint or, as you said I've made my decision, and that's it, and no additional evidence was taken on that issue.
Correct. I think the transcripts when the district attorney's office and the circuit court and the public defender trial office addressed that there was some confusion regarding exactly what the purpose of that was.
Yeah, they sent it back, but they gave them a little discretion because they said, if warranted.
Right.
Take evidence if warranted, and they said it's over with.
Tell you what bothers me. One, I think that the right to counsel is a constitutionally protected right, that Miranda, as now interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court, protects that right and is prophylactic for protecting that right. But what has grown up about Miranda is just a series of rules, because the fact situations are so different from one case to the other. So you've got a whole series of rules, Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, are they the same, are they not? And now, if the lawyer shows up after he's waived for a second time, too bad, right? If the lawyer shows up 15 minutes before he waives, he being the defendant, then you suppress. It's just so fortuitous. If he's stuck in traffic, the defendant loses his rights. If he's a fast driver and doesn't get picked up for speeding, the defendant has his rights. It just doesn't seem to me that's the way the ship should be run. It seems to me that to the extent possible, and it's not always possible, you ought to have some rules that law enforcement knows and understands, that the defense counsel know and understand, and that courts know and understand and enforce. And they ought not to apply depending on whether the lawyer is 15 minutes early or 15 minutes late. And the words you read from Miranda, and there are others, would just say, hey, you ask for a lawyer, finish, get the lawyer, get him in, get another waiver, tell the lawyer can advise him, etc. But and you can tell from some of my dissents that I would favor a rule that protects the right more than the U.S. Supreme Court has done, and I would put it under our Constitution. But I'm sort of in the stage now where I'm not sure we should be slicing and dicing all this. So how do you help me so that I would hold for your client and other clients like that when I'm concerned about these minor differences from case to case that are totally, totally fortuitous? He happens to have a state public defender in this case. In another case, the state public defender may have been in jail, heard about a new guy coming in and said, I want to see him, right? How do you draft something that makes sense?
I would certainly advocate for a broader rule that, you know, protects defendants. But I understand the court's point. If you have a suspect arrested for the very first time, has no family members, invokes his right shortly after arrest, if the police say, well, we don't need to do a Gernstein hearing until next Monday, let's let him just sit in the cell, it could create tremendous pressure to say, look, I want to talk again. I'll waive my right to an attorney.
Especially when the law enforcement has told him when he first came in, it'll be better for you if you tell us the truth.
Correct. I think that's just a reality of this case, that at times he was told that his initial descriptions of what happened were the complete opposite of the complaining witness, which I would disagree with that interpretation. And he was also told during the initial custodial interrogation that his salvation wouldn't be to make something up, which I think obviously increased the pressure on him to change his version of events. Thank you.
Justice Prosser.
What is the evidence that the defendant knew or suspected or requested that the attorney would show up?
Well, that he knew the precise time or approximate time she would show up. The only concrete evidence in the record is the telephone message note from the mother received at the public defender office. We do know that Attorney Ewan showed up at the police department at approximately 1 p.m., and there is in the record a photocopy of the phone note showing a phone call placed to the public defender office at, my memory is, 12:07 p.m.
Well, the mother knows that her son is in jail. Mm-hmm. Does that necessarily mean that she talked to the son and that the son asked for an attorney?
I think that's a reasonable inference. And in fairness to the state as well, there was testimony at one of the suppression hearings by Lieutenant Graham that he said he seemed to have a memory or had a memory of calling the mother to let her know that David was being held there. But he couldn't remember any specifics of what he said.
Lieutenant Graham called?
There was testimony by Lieutenant Graham that he had a memory of placing a call to the mother. He couldn't remember what was said.
Okay. He placed the call. I thought there was a suggestion that the defendant placed the call.
There was a suggestion of that effect, but there was no specific concrete finding of fact by the circuit court on that.
Well, how would the defendant know that mom called the public defender?
He would not. He would not know if mother called or if Lieutenant Graham called. And, you know, in this particular case, he had no idea that Attorney Ewan had showed up.
That's what I think Justice Brasser's question was.
My follow-up question is that somebody called the mother. It might have been David, might have been a lieutenant or some other police officer. But if it was David, and he explicitly asked for an attorney, asked for his mother to get an attorney, wasn't it sometime after that call that he agreed to talk with
Detective Haynes?
Yes.
Correct. It was approximately 3 p.m. when he was returned to the interview room and was again...
No, I mean even the first time.
Oh, correct. It was as soon as the first custodial interrogation ended, and it sounds like they were just about to enter the holding cell again, Detective Haynes said that Mr. Stevens said, look, I'd like to keep talking to you. You know, I want to keep talking. So he did initiate, it's clear he did initiate contact with the police prior to anybody placing a telephone call to Attorney Ewan.
Well, one question that arises from this colloquy is, if a police officer called the mother and said, we got your son in jail, and if the mother said words to the effect, he has a lawyer, or I am going to call his lawyer and tell the lawyer, then the question is that the information or knowledge of that one police officer is then imputed to all of the police officers.
Correct. That's my position.
Your position. Okay. Then your position has to be, once the law enforcement knows there's a lawyer, they cannot even accept his voluntary request that he talk with the police. They have to wait until the lawyer comes.
Yeah, I don't know if that would turn on the distinction of Attorney Ewan was, you know, appointed as his counsel on the sex offender registry, so he had a Sixth Amendment right to counsel there, or, you know, that he would still be in a theoretically in a position to knowingly and intelligently waive under the Fifth because she had not yet been appointed on that case. He had not yet made an initial appearance in court.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks. And you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state of Wisconsin.
Thank you. And may it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Sally Wellman, representing the state, which is the respondent in this case. We ask the court to hold that all of Mr. Stevens' oral and written statements made after the second interrogation are admissible because they were not obtained in violation of his Miranda right to counsel. There are three separate reasons for that. The first two are alternatives to each other. The first one is that, in our view, at around 10:30, after he had said, I think I want to talk to my lawyer, the detective immediately stopped the interrogation as he was walking him back to the cell. The defendant admittedly, concededly initiated contact about the subject matter of the investigation. And it's our position that he also then waived the right to counsel. That's 10:35-ish in the morning, well before the attorney ever even knew anything had happened, that he was in jail or anything. So if you accept that that was a valid waiver, as we believe it was, then we don't have to get into this. We're done. We don't have to go into anything that happened after that. And the defendant seems to, the defendant is saying, well, it's because it sounded futuristic. And the problem is that when the only person who testified about that, what happened between the two of them, was Detective Haynes. And what he said was the defendant defendant said, I want to talk to you, I changed my mind, I want to talk to you about this. Detective Haynes, as he should, properly said, you've already told me you want counsel, I cannot talk to you anymore about this unless you waive your right to counsel. And then Detective Haynes said that the defendant indicated he intended to waive his right to counsel. What's a little unclear is we don't know exactly what was meant by indicated because no follow-up questions were asked. Detective seemed to use, if we read the whole transcript, he seemed to use the word indicated to mean said because he also said, when David said this, I indicated I couldn't talk to him. It's possible he also meant he said something that I interpreted to indicate. So that I can see that as the only possible reason why you might say, well, there just isn't enough of a factual record to say that's a waiver. If you do that, then we get to our alternative argument, which is nonetheless, he clearly waived after Detective Haynes returned to the department after interviewing the child victim and reapproached him and said, you wanted me to come back and talk to you. I can't talk to you unless you initiate. We've got to make it clear. It's you who wants to talk to me. He said, that's clear. And then he re-Mirandized him, and he waived his rights again. Now, it wouldn't have to be that formal, so that at 10:30-ish in the morning, when we believe he waived again, he didn't have to give him his rights all over again. I mean, you can waive your rights less formally than that. But to be safe, Detective Haynes the second time did give him all of his rights again, so he once again knew his right to counsel, and he waived it. And the only thing that defendant can hang his hat on as to why that isn't a perfectly valid waiver that occurred before the second interrogation is that in the meantime, unbeknownst to the defendant, the public defender who represented him on a different case and had apparently represented him in past cases, showed up at the police station and asked to see him. And the defendant is hinging that on the language in Miranda that he had a right to consult with counsel before interrogation, subsequent interrogation. Well, he did, but he waived that. That's the whole point. If he hadn't waived the right to counsel, then, of course, the police could not have continued to talk to him, even though he initiated. So, yeah, he had that right. He had the right to either consult with counsel before further interrogation or the right not to talk to the police anymore without an attorney present. He waived both of those rights. And that seems to be the part that the defendant doesn't want to, you know, to deal with squarely.
Ms. Wellman?
Yes.
Isn't it highly unusual if you've got an attorney who represents somebody on a pending case and that attorney shows up at the jail and says, I want to see my client, isn't it highly unusual that the sheriff's department or the police department would refuse to let the attorney see the defendant?
I don't know. I've not seen this fact situation before.
I've never heard of a situation where an attorney goes to the jail or the prison or whatever and says, I represent Joe, and I want to see Joe, and she does represent Joe in a pending case, and the officers would refuse. On what basis would they refuse?
Well, I don't know that he knew that she didn't say, I represent him on a pending case. She just said, I want to see my client. I represent him.
Well, that sounds like my client I represent him.
Well, he didn't actually represent, I mean, as far as the record shows, I mean, because he hadn't been charged yet, she had not been appointed to represent him on this uncharged case yet.
But she did apparently represent him. I don't think there's any question about that. On the failure to register as a sex offender and to give the correct address at which he was residing.
Right. She said she was representing him on a pending case at that time. We're assuming that that was the case. I have no reason to think it wasn't. But that doesn't give, she doesn't have any right to see him. All the rights are the defendant's rights. The fact that she represents him on another charge case that's over here doesn't give him a Fifth Amendment Miranda right to consult with her at that particular point in time. And he didn't have a Sixth Amendment right because he hadn't been charged yet.
Well, now the U.S. Supreme Court has pretty well taken care of that distinction between the Fifth Amendment and Sixth Amendment and being charged and not being charged. They did that rather recently in Montale. We've had some arguments here in other cases as to the meaning of Montale, but the U.S. Supreme Court basically, as I understand Montale, eliminated the distinction between Fifth and Sixth Amendment tied to has the person been charged or not charged. Isn't that correct?
I wouldn't go that far. I think what it says is you can waive both. If you have both, you can waive both.
Well,
but you have to have both, and he didn't have both.
Didn't they say that the distinction was outmoded and unworkable, and they weren't going to enforce? It was Michigan versus somebody that they were overturning with Montale. Isn't that what they said?
They overruled Michigan versus Jackson, but not as broadly, my understanding is, as you're saying, so that the Sixth Amendment right is still offense-specific. And, you know, it's possible in one setting to waive both when you waive your Miranda rights. But that does, I certainly don't see anything in that decision that suggests that that completely undoes the whole body of law that says you don't have a Sixth Amendment right unless you're charged or otherwise formal proceedings are against you.
In what is the closest fact situation in a Wisconsin case to this one that you would say might govern?
Well, certainly we see Ward and Hansen as governing in the sense that the attorney showed up apparently at the request of someone else. We don't even know actually
right.
In this case that Mother requested, because all Mother did was leave a message that he was in jail for sexually assaulting an 8-year-old. But assuming the attorney then took it upon herself to then go to the jail. So whether the attorney did it unilaterally or Mother wanted her to and she did it because of that, it wasn't the defendant who asked her to come there. He didn't know she was there. So what he doesn't know can't affect the knowingness of his subsequent waiver. The defendant is saying, well, this is different because he initially invoked. Well, he did initially invoke, but then he immediately waived shortly after 10:30, and waived again before the subsequent interrogation. And what the defendants, if you really parse down what I think the defendant wants, is a rule that says if by fortuity there is a time gap between initiation and waiver, and an attorney shows up during that time gap, that changes everything. And suddenly you have to let the attorney see him, or at least tell him the attorney was here. And there is no law that supports that. This falls right between those gaps, and the rationale doesn't support it. Because if it's true that Miranda means that before you waive your rights to a subsequent interrogation, once you've invoked and initiated, if Miranda means that you have to have the right, the opportunity to consult with a lawyer, then the defendant's concession that if the detective hadn't had to go away and interview the child, he could have interviewed him right then, he could have waived and interviewed him, and everything would be fine. That can't be if his reading of Miranda is right. What Miranda means is if you want to consult with an attorney before the second interrogation, you have a right to do that. If you want him present during the second interrogation, you have a right to that. You also have the right to waive both of those, and he did. What he didn't have was the right to consult with the attorney between the initiation and waiver to decide whether to waive.
He didn't have that right. And you quote or paraphrase the cases essentially, what he did not know cannot affect the knowingness of his waiver. And that has some character to it. That rings a bell. And yet, unlike in Ward and Hansen, here you have the defendant personally invoking and requesting, exercising his right to have an attorney present. And although it flows, it's easy to say what he doesn't know cannot affect the knowingness of his waiver. Isn't that what this case is about? If he, number one, personally invoked and said he wanted an attorney, and the attorney showed, and an attorney showed up, the argument is that indeed it does implicate the knowingness of his waiver. If he personally invoked and the attorney showed up and he knew it, he likely would not have waived, right?
But the voluntariness, knowingness, and willingness of your waiver doesn't depend on whether you would have made a different decision if you had known something else. If you're being questioned about beating someone and you don't know they died yet, if you'd known they died, you might not have confessed. But you don't have a right to know that at that point. So I think to look back, and that's part of what the trial court did wrong here, I think, too, in addition to relying on Middleton, which hopefully we'll get to. He also said, well, the state didn't prove that he would have made the same decision if he had known. That's not the test for a knowing waiver of the right to counsel during custodial interrogation. The test is you have to know what the right is, which he clearly did. He was told you have a right to have an attorney. You don't have to say anything. You have to know the consequences. He was told anything you say can be used against you in a court of law. He knew that. That's all he had to know. And I have the same struggle, I think, that the Chief Justice has, to the extent that if we were to try to write a rule based on this case, based on the state constitution, I have no idea what that rule would be, because I think we all agree that if he waived before the attorney ever got there, then he's just out of luck. If the attorney got there at 4 o'clock after he had waived twice, initiated and waived twice, he's out of luck. So it's this fortuity of timing that she happened to appear at 1 o'clock because she had a note from his mother, a phone message from his mother saying he was in the jail for a child for sexual assaulting an 8-year-old. That kind of fortuity shouldn't be what protects defendants' constitutional rights. What protects defendants' constitutional rights is the right to be given your Miranda warnings, which he was. The right to have interrogation cease if you invoke your right to counsel, your Miranda right to counsel. If you initiate, the police can again talk to you but they can't be the ones to initiate it. And even if you initiate, they cannot go ahead and talk to you unless you then again waive your rights. And to try and build in additional protections based on circumstances that were unknown to the defendant and not of his doing, it seems to me then everything is just a case-by-case basis, and we have no rules to govern either the police or defendants or the courts. I did want to speak very briefly, too, regarding why we don't think Middleton that defendants should get relief based on Middleton. And first of all, in our view, Middleton is no longer good law because Anson overruled the Harrison part of Middleton. And under Blum, a Supreme Court decision overruling a prior decision, a court of appeals decision, overrules it entirely. It no longer has any precedential value. And let me just quote from Blum. It's paragraph 56. That we conclude that a court of appeals decision expressly overruled by this court no longer retains any precedential value unless this court expressly states that it is leaving portions of the court of appeals decision intact. Here in Anson, this court didn't expressly say we are leaving these parts intact.
It didn't expressly say we're overruling Middleton. Didn't it say something like, if Middleton can be interpreted to mean or interpreted to say, then we withdraw that?
I don't believe it used the withdraw language. It definitely used the word overrule.
Right. But it was dealing with, we hold that a Harrison hearing is not an evidentiary hearing, and overrule the Court of Appeals decision in Middleton to the extent it held. So it says, and you're right, I use withdrawal, that they overrule the language to the extent that. And that's not quite the same thing as overruling. It's different. Now, whether that difference should be distinguished or not, I don't know. But that's what we're talking about.
Right.
The language is different.
Right. You certainly could say that they implied that they weren't overruling everything.
That's right.
But our position is under Blum, implied isn't good enough. Now, if
what's in Middleton that's left? Can the rest of Middleton stand without the evidentiary hearing?
Well, the holding that his waiver of counsel wasn't knowing would stand if it's not overruled. The problem I have, particularly in the case with Middleton, I mean, there may be other kinds of cases where, if it's not expressly overruled, but it's retained, but it's implied retained. One is just, it's too hard for people to know which it is. That's why I advocate, you know, whichever rule you want, make it clear so everybody knows. But in this kind of case in particular, they're so intertwined because the Harrison issue only existed because Middleton said the trial court erred by not suppressing. The next question is whether that was nonetheless harmless error because he testified and said the same stuff. So when they're so intertwined like that, I think it only makes sense for the rule to be everything was overruled. If you don't agree with that, if Middleton retains any vitality or still has precedential value, I should say, then we don't believe it controls here because in Middleton, the attorney was there because the defendant called his wife and told her, call Hoosander and tell him to come down here, who happened to be the attorney. And the police knew that. So factually, it's distinguishable. At least on the record we have here, there's no evidence that the defendant called his mother and said, get my attorney or an attorney or attorney UN down here. So that's factually distinguishable. Finally, we would say Middleton's just wrong. And you don't have to go to the extent of, again, overruling it because factually it's distinguishable. But the Court of Appeals in Middleton said, well, his waiver wasn't knowing because he didn't know he was out there. And that's in conflict with the definition we now know of what you have to have a knowing waiver, which is you have to know the right and you have to know the consequences. You don't have to know all the other things, including the presence of an attorney who is outside, who was there and wants to see you, or even is still there and would like to talk to you, you don't have to know that for your waiver to be knowing.
Would that be your position if the facts were that, in the record, that he called his mother and asked his mother to call his attorney at the public defender's office? Would that still be your same argument?
Yes, it would still be our same argument. It's a little tougher just because it isn't so easy to distinguish Moran and or to tie into Burbine and Ward, because in those cases he didn't, you know, he didn't know, he didn't ask for, he didn't have the attorney there.
Yeah, but you emphasize in your argument that whether or not he knows the attorney is there is irrelevant to the subsequent knowing waiver.
Right.
So it seems to me your answer would be he could invoke his right to an attorney. He could even personally make contact to get his attorney there. The attorney could show up, be waiting in the reception area for hours, and then he decides to knowingly waive.
That's right.
And that would be just fine.
Yes, because he doesn't have the right to consult with an attorney before he decides whether to waive. He can protect himself entirely by insisting on his right to counsel, at which point the police cannot interrogate him anymore unless an attorney is present. He chose not to do that. So his rights were protected. It's not, we don't believe it's fair to say, well, his rights weren't protected because he didn't know these other things. His rights were protected. He chose to waive them. And I only say it's more difficult if he's the one who called mom and said, because you don't have the factual distinction. But we think that the legal argument, you have a right to consult with an attorney before the second interrogation, if you choose to exercise it. Have a right to have an attorney present with you during the second interrogation, if you choose to exercise it. You have the right to waive both of those before the second interrogation, and he did that. There's no intermediate additional right to, well, you have a right to consult with an attorney if it happens to be convenient because the attorney happens to be there, regardless of how the attorney came to be there.
Ms. Wellman, I want to get this part straight because I find it very unusual. You got a situation, as I understand it, where the Court of Appeals allows for the supplementing of the record. The district attorney's office, as I understand it, wanted to supplement the record. The judge says something along the lines, I'm not going to let you supplement the record because it wouldn't have made any difference to my decision because I was relying on Middleton and it wouldn't change the situation. That's really an unusual kind of a sequence of events. Does the judge give any explanation as to why he wouldn't allow supplementing of the record other than it wouldn't change my mind?
Well, I believe he also relied on the fact that the defendant objected. I mean, if the defendant hadn't objected, I think there may have been an evidentiary hearing. But the defendant objected and said, we don't need any further evidence.
Well, it really is weird, isn't it?
It's very strange. My understanding of what happened is that at some point after the first suppression hearing and the trial court's ruling, the defendant's mother said to the prosecutor, and we don't know in what context, but said to the prosecutor, I called the attorney because my son called me from the jail and told me to, or asked me to. Well, I think that the prosecutor, to give him full credit, felt like, well, ethically, this might change the whole landscape. And having lost, we were already taking an appeal and felt like, well, if the facts are different than everyone thought, then we better go back and straighten this out. For whatever reason, and it's not entirely clear from the record, the defense did not want a further evidentiary hearing. Now, it's possible you could infer that it's because he knows that that's not the facts, but we don't know that. So, but there just are no further facts on that point.
Thank you.
If that story were true, when would that call have been made?
Well, we don't know. We don't know. There's nothing in the state's motion to indicate it, that the mother said anything about when the call was made. There is also testimony by Detective Graham, to clarify that point a little bit. Before the defendant ever, before the police ever got the phone call that the defendant had sexually, was being accused of sexually assaulting this little girl at the swimming pool, the defendant's mother had called Detective Graham and told him that the defendant was violating his rules. He wasn't reporting where he was living. He wasn't living where he was supposed to. He was driving without a license or on a suspended license. She was telling him all the things the defendant was doing that he wasn't supposed to do. After that, and we don't know exactly how long before the assault that happened, then the police got the call reporting a sexual assault, investigated, arrested him, brought him to the police station. Apparently, after the defendant was picked up and brought to jail, at some point in there, Detective Graham called the mother to tell him he was in jail. We don't know exactly when that occurred, and we don't know whether he just wanted her to know, okay, he's in jail now, he's not out any longer. We don't know. What we do know is, though, that Detective Graham didn't know that the defendant had invoked or waived his Miranda rights at that first interrogation. So it's not the situation that he called her because the defendant had invoked his rights, because he didn't know he had invoked his rights. So I guess the ambiguity is there, but I don't think it makes any difference in this case, just like it doesn't make any difference if we impute knowledge of one officer to another, even if Detective Haynes is the one who knew that the attorney came to talk to the defendant and said, no, you can't talk to him, or even if he had gotten his voicemail from her saying, I represent him, give me a call back, that wouldn't make any difference, because our position is if he invoked his right to counsel, he then initiated conversation, he then waived again, and he didn't have the right to consult with the attorney in between those times to protect his Fifth Amendment right. That was protected by his initial receipt of the rights, by him having to initiate the conversation again. The police couldn't have talked to him legally again about the subject matter of the investigation if he hadn't initiated, and then obtaining a valid waiver. There are no further questions. We would ask that you would affirm the Court of Appeals decision reversing the trial court's order suppressing the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lizotte.
Yes. Thank you. It is Mr. Stevens' position that suspects who do personally invoke their Fifth Amendment right to counsel are in an entirely different class than suspects who never personally invoke that right. In advocating for a rule that helps both my client, I think is easy to follow. It is my position in my reading of Miranda and his progeny. If the suspect has invoked his right to consult with an attorney shows up at the police station or the jail and says, I would like to consult with the client, and there's no practical or appropriate reasons for denying access, the attorney should be allowed access, or the suspect should at least be informed that the attorney is there. Obviously, I strongly disagree with the state's position that initiating contact, the contact that Mr. Stevens initiated, in and of itself constitutes a knowing and intelligent waiver of his right to counsel. In Oregon versus Bradshaw, the Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court, made clear that the initiation of conversation does not amount to waiver of the previously invoked right to counsel. The question becomes, was a subsequent waiver knowing under the totality of the circumstances, including the necessary prerequisite fact that the defendant reopened the dialogue. In Justice Powell's concurring opinion in that case, he points out that all the justices in that decision were unanimous that the right to counsel is a prime example of a right requiring special protection of the knowing waiver standard. And I obviously disagree that simply reopening dialogue can in any way constitute a knowing and intelligent waiver of the right to consult with counsel. And I did want to point out that in Arizona versus Roberson, my reading of it at 486 U.S. at 687 to 88, 108 Escort at 2101. Reading that, it's my understanding that the United States Supreme Court says when one police officer is aware that the suspect has invoked his or her right to counsel, that knowledge is imputed to all other officers in the department. So, again, in summation, it is my position that Detective Graham had a responsibility to either inform Mr. Stevens that Attorney Ewing was there or to facilitate the contact. I understand the court's concern about the fortuity of circumstances, but I think that will, you know, that's just part of life. A particular suspect that's very savvy and mentally tough won't talk. There's just things in life, the circumstances are going to differ, and these cases at times will have to be decided on a case-by-case basis. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Mr. Lazant and Ms. Wellman for yet another discussion on suppression of evidence and the Miranda warnings. When was Miranda decided? 1968, yeah. And we're still getting different situations and different responses to the Miranda right. That ends our hearing on 09AP2057CR, State versus David W. Stevens. The court will meet in closed conference until at 10 after 3. The court will sit again in oral argument for one case at the end of October. So at least for this week, we're adjourned.